I love this room. I love this room. Yeah. And the whole, and it's not just this room, but like the little walkway that comes over and the setting of the castle. I'm amazed that we've been able to have so long in this room. I've been in this room where there's been five deep, the length of the rope. You know, you had no chance of even saying a prayer or, you know, thanking God for the life and ministry. So this is quite tremendous that we get to have this moment. I suppose it's because it's a hot summer's day and it's the end of the day.
Now, that's the voice of my guest, Canon Dr. Rhys Bazant, speaking in the room where Martin Luther was held for 9 months in the Tower of Wartburg in central Germany. Now, he was held for his own protection and spent his time translating the Bible from Greek to German, a truly epic change with huge ramifications for really all of life as they knew it, and as we're learning, for the shape of Western society since then. Canon Bazant is the Dean of Missional Leadership and Director of the Jonathan Edwards Centre at the Ridley Theological College in Melbourne. He's been leading Reformation tours in the Northern Hemisphere for 10 years now, so he's certainly well-versed, but never blithe, it would seem, about his material. I mean, that grab tells you he's still enthralled by what he encounters. So I'll invite him to share that enthusiasm right now. Rhys Bazant, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you, Geraldine. It's great to be with you.
The Wartburg Castle was originally built, I understand, in the Middle Ages, and it overlooks the town of Eisenach, pretty much in the centre of Germany, and it's where Martin Luther translated the New Testament from Greek into German. Now, you've been there many times, I take it, but you're still enthralled by it. Is it the history, or what is it that makes such an impression?
Yes, certainly the setting set high above the Thuringian forests, and the town Eisenach has extraordinary history as well. Not only did Luther go to school there, but J.S. Bach was born there. So the setting is just fantastic. And the castle itself not only has this grab of Reformation history, but also it was a great site of the medieval poetry competitions. So it represents the best of German culture. Some castles don't. Some castles have a more gruesome kind of history. But this castle, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, has a very particular place in the more liberal, poetic, artistic side of German history.
And I think there's a thick forest, I've read, below it, where Luther was actually kidnapped by the prince of his own principality because he'd been put on trial by the emperor.
Yes, so the story is extraordinary. He'd been appeared before the emperor in Worms not only a few weeks earlier, and of course that was the great encounter, the symbolic heart of the Reformation, where Luther takes his stand on scriptural authority. But because he was now both excommunicated and an outlaw, he had no civil or civic rights in Germany anymore. Anyone could kill him and not be punished. So he's in great physical danger, and on his way back from the encounter with the emperor in the Thuringian forest, he's kidnapped. He doesn't know at the time who's doing the kidnapping, but it turns out to be his own prince in Saxony who takes him to his own castle there for safekeeping.
And keeps him there for 9 months. And just tell us a little bit about what you see when you're there.
So a classic medieval castle with the central area, high towers, buildings around. There's the two sections. There's one that's more palatial, where princes or Elizabeth of Hungary lived for a time. But there's also smaller rooms, which is where the servants would have been housed. And Martin Luther's house arrest was in one of those servants' rooms. So there are two distinct parts of the castle.
And do you actually, I mean, well, clearly you do, by the sound of it, you sort of feel the sheer scale of what you're seeing?
Yeah, so the room is quite humble. There's only one or two elements in it that are original. One of the original elements is a whale bone, a vertebrae from a whale, which was used as a stool or a small table. But the number of tourists who've come through there for hundreds of years and the way it's so pared back kind of belies its importance or belies its grandeur. So you might expect something more kind of over the top or elegant like some of the other palatial rooms, but it's actually not that. The other interesting thing about the room is that generations of tourists went there in particularly the 18th and 19th centuries, and they scraped back some of the masonry from the wall, which they thought had been damaged by Luther throwing an ink pot at the devil. And so they've gravel, with their fingers effectively, they've chipped back at the masonry. Now, the story is really a legend, and you can still see, though, the part of the room where tourists have done their thing over the last few hundred years.
Let's talk about Luther's fights with the devil, because it's a reminder, these stories of the devil tempting him, that you say helped Luther define who he was, how he saw himself.
Yes, so Luther was a late medieval man. We might think of him, or the 20th century presented him as a modern man, but actually we're realizing that so many of his assumptions belonged to a world that was dying. Mm. And he saw himself as part of a grand spiritual battle, and the devil's tempting him, or the Anfechtungen, which Luther described as his temptations, were very real. And of course Luther himself was a conflicted man, and his own experience with those great spiritual depths in his own life lead him to the explanations of the devil in his life. He also sees his views over and against the papal church, and sees there a great spiritual battle as well.
Because with resonance of Jesus being tempted by the devil on the hills above Jerusalem.
So
when you go on these tours, what else do you see in Germany? Do you go to Wittenberg, where Luther nailed, or whatever he did do with the 95 Theses, to the door of the
yes.
church?
Yes, so I take groups of students every couple of years to Germany, and we spend lots of time in the first week of our travels in the small Saxon villages where Luther lived and served, or was born, or was died. So there's lots of Luther story, and the Germans have done extraordinarily well, especially in this, the 500th Reformation year, of renovating the churches and rethinking the museums and the story they tell. So yes, we visit Wittenberg and Eisenach and Eislem and Torgau and any number of those small towns where Luther had such a mighty impact.
And then you move on, I understand, to Geneva in Switzerland, to a cemetery. And this was the first time you'd been there, I gather, fairly recently, and you weren't quite sure where to look for a certain resting place. Of whom? Let us know.
Yes. So I've been to Geneva quite a few times, but I'd never found my way to the cemetery where John Calvin is buried.
Because the three men, aren't they, really, are sort of Luther, Calvin and Zwingli, who was the Swiss man.
That's right. And perhaps Bucer, who was in Strasbourg as a fourth leader. He played quite an important role in the English Reformation later. But in Geneva, at least, Calvin wanted to be buried without any marking stones. So there is, in the particular cemetery, Plan Palais, just outside the city walls, of course, a grave now that has JC on the head of the grave, effectively, placed there after Calvin's day. So we assume it's where Calvin was buried, but there's some doubt about it. But the first time I was there and discovered where it was, I was going on a little wild goose chase and find it eventually. Very, very low-key grave. It was quite a moving moment, actually.
But something else very non-low-key has been erected in, which Calvin probably wouldn't have liked, would he?
So in Geneva, there's a great Reformation wall, which was built for the 400th anniversary of Calvin's birth at the beginning of the 20th century. And that Reformation wall is very grand, very tall. And because Calvin didn't want to be memorialized, in this wall there are five reformers from different parts of Switzerland and France. And Calvin's amongst others, so he's not having attention drawn to him in particular, but he's just a tiny bit taller and he's a few inches in front of the others. So there's a nice kind of gentle tipping of the hat to his role in the Genevan Reformation.
Mm. Poor old Calvin.
I know, that's right, that's right. He can't get it right.
And now, so just finally, you move to London. Calvin feared that the whole reform wouldn't take hold, and London is perceived now to be the real test for the Reformation. So take us to the landmark that's significant in the history of that giant set of moves in London.
Yes, so just outside of St. Paul's Cathedral in London, St. Paul's Cross was, in the Middle Ages, first of all, and then later too, a point of discussion of new ideas. And in its day, it had a large stage where anyone could preach. And in lots of market towns in England, there's a cross at which people could preach as people came into the town for market day and hear sermons before they went out to their villages again. So St. Paul's Cross functions like that. So it represents something of the pre-Reformation church in England and the Reformation movement as well, because Luther's books were not only discussed there, but Luther's books were also burned there. It becomes kind of an early center point of debate and division.
What a fantastic sounding tour. Thank you very much indeed for telling us all about it.
Thank you.
Canon Dr. Rhys Bazant at Ridley College, who's been leading these Reformation tours for the last 10 years. Now, they're open to the public, you could hear my sort of interest, as well as to students. So if you go to the Ridley College website, you can find some details. And I'd love to hear from you if you're undertaking anything of this nature. I'd love to hear the stories.